never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Fourth Canal Podcast. Yay, we're back once again. So I'm back in hosting duties, and I put Darren in the naughty chair, so he's over there.
It's very comfortable, thank you very much.
And we brought Stacey too for a bit of levity.
Hello, I'm here.
Yay. So we'll start with what we've been watching recently. Darren, you've been watching some great films recently.
Some classic films, some amazing films, some of the best films made. Now we'll talk about them when we get to the top 10. But no, I watched The Book of Henry, which is one of those films which has wonderfully, like, it's very rare that you get to see a film derail a director's career in real time. Colin Trevor Morrow famously directed Jurassic World and got the ninth Star Wars film, or had the ninth Star Wars film until this came out.
Yeah, but then he got to quickly taken away from
it. But Trevor Morrow is like, he's one of those directors who started on the indie circuit. He did Safety Not Guaranteed, which is the time travel movie with Will Forte, I believe, and then basically jumped up to the big leagues, and then he tried to do that thing that, like, directors do to prove they sell street cred, which is make a small indie film beforehand, or make a, you know, between big projects. And The Book of Henry is amazing! It is, like, astounding! Like, it's one of those films that you look at and you think, all the people who had to say yes for this movie to happen, all the actors who had to read the script and say, this is what I want to be a part of, all the producers who are like, this is what we want to invest money in, all the, you know, cast members, crew members, like, all the people in the editing bay who are like, this is the final cut of the movie that we're going to release, all the people in distribution who are like, this is going to get a cinematic release, all the people who had to say yes for this to happen, in the myriad of multiverses in which we exist in the universe where Book of Henry happened, Niall. And don't you feel special about that? The unique confluence of circumstances that have to make this terrible movie possible. That's astounding.
But is it not the case that he made a $1.5 billion movie and therefore, as a result, was given free rein to do whatever he wanted?
You would think that, but you watched The Book of Henry, right?
Yeah, I have, it's dreadful.
That you know, billion-dollar movie gets you 10 minutes into the core premise, in which Naomi Watts plays a waitress, a single mother waitress with a 12-year-old son who is a super genius, who relies on him to make all of her decisions. There's a moment early in the film where her boss tries to pay her more money, and she's like, wait, I have to run this by my 12-year-old son. There's a moment later on in the movie where, you know, her best friend is like, oh, you need a man, girl, and she's like, oh, if only I could find a man as good as my 12-year-old son. Cut to the two of them lying in bed together, kissing on the lips while he does her tax returns. And this isn't even the most bonkers part of the movie. It's astounding. It's amazing that this exists. It's a terrible movie. You should not watch this movie under any circumstances, but if you do, you will enjoy it. It's rare that you watch a movie, that I watch a movie. I've seen lots of movies. I've seen lots of terrible movies. But it's rare that you watch them with your mouth agape at every single decision that's made. Like, this is a movie that seems to suggest that anything is possible, that you can live your dream. It's like The Room. It's like The Disaster Artist in real life. It's like Colin Trevor Morrow dreamed this and it happened. And it's like, wow.
Right. Yeah, no.
It is atrocious.
Because I watched it and I was like, this is a really bad film. I didn't find the levels of joy in it being a really bad film that you seem to have found.
It's astounding. Come on, tell me. Like, I occasionally watch bad films for, like, research. So I watch, like, Russian propaganda films. You know, I watched... what did I see this week? I saw... I saw The Cloverfield Paradox. Like, I see bad films all the time, but it's very rare that I see a bad film that is so inspiringly terrible.
And two of them starred Naomi Watts as well.
What's been going on?
What's she doing?
But I also watched It, starring the same child actor as Book of Henry. It's great. I loved it the first time. I loved it even more the second time. Great Stephen King sort of homage. It's wonderful in that, like, it's not just It. It's also, like, just King nostalgia in general. It's got a bit of Stand By Me, a bit of Kerry going on there. It's very clever because it plays into adult fears as well. Like, it's one of the clever sort of concepts of it. It's not just about a killer clown. It's got all this stuff happening in the background about abuse and this sort of stuff as well. And then I also watched Seven Samurai, which was great, the Kurosawa film, which inspired every action movie ever, every Jean-Claude Van Damme, Sylvester Stallone movie that you've ever seen can trace its roots back to this sort of bit of Japanese cinema from, 1954. Astounding, beautiful piece of work. 3.5 hours long there with an intermission.
Which whole is week it takes to watch that film.
All of the Seven Samurai. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I haven't watched it in 15 years because it's 3.5 hours long with an intermission.
And you have to watch it for six before
you get into it. You can't really get into it. It's got a lot of nuance going on there.
It's a lot of historical backstory.
Yeah, not as big a commitment as the 46 Ronin.
Or our 9 or 10,000 BC, which is just like 900. Once you get to the 9,998 one, you're like, I'll have to finish.
They're all out of ideas at this point. Why is Jack Black still around? And why did they swap in Michael Cera for Jesse Eisenberg?
What was the one where... Oh, it's in the end of 22 Jump Street where they...
where they run through all the sequels.
Yeah, they swap out Seth Rogen.
They swap out Jonah Hill
for Seth Rogen. For Seth Rogen.
Oh, great to have you back. I was never gone. I was but yeah, that was fun. That was me. What about you, Stacey?
What about me? Well, my watching this week was sort of themed around PTA and PDP.
I don't like it.
Get anachronistic about it. That's the wrong word. I'm using acronyms. PTA.
I like it.
I'm using acronyms in the time in which you're not supposed to use acronyms.
Acronymistic.
So,
getting antagonistic about the acronym.
Yes, this is getting very antagonistic.
It's awesomely alliterative, though.
It's wonderful.
Wonderful.
So, PTA was Paul Thomas Anderson. I saw Phantom Thread the other day, and I really enjoyed it. I wasn't particularly excited going in, which now seems odd, but at the time I was like, you know, it's Daniel Day-Lewis, it's Paul Thomas Anderson, the score is by Johnny Greenwood. Like, these are all strong elements. He's playing a dressmaker. It's about a sort of twisted love affair. Like, in hindsight now, I'm like, of course I should have been excited about this film. This sounds on paper incredible.
Like the reverse Book of Henry experience, where I was like, yes. I see so many bad movies. How can this bad movie be better than or worse than all the other bad movies? And then it is.
That just surpasses your expectations.
I feel like you had beer.
I feel like you had the better experience, though.
I would recommend Phantom Thread over The Book of Henry.
That's only because you haven't watched The Book of Henry this week.
I mean, there's no...
I would recommend all of Adam Sandler's back catalogue over The Book of Henry.
Harsh.
Yeah, I'd recommend almost any film I've seen in the last 5 years over The Book of Henry.
Except for Grown Ups, because that is...
Okay. And Grown Ups too.
Yeah. I'm not watching Grown Ups. It will be
I set the trap.
But yeah, Phantom Thread. I wasn't excited going in. I was so excited coming in. I loved it so much. The performances are incredible from Daniel Day-Lewis. And this lady, is her name Vicky Creeps?
Creeps.
Every time I say it out loud, I'm like...
Creeps, I would imagine, yeah.
Creeps.
Okay, Creeps.
Not a flattering name. Wonderful actress. and Leslie Manville, who plays Daniel Day-Lewis' sister Cyril, is incredible. It's sort of really twisty, really turny. Like, technically, it's nearly flawless. I'm just gushing at this stage. But, like, the cinematography is beautiful.
It's an incredibly well-made film. Like, it is astoundingly beautiful and well-constructed.
Well-tailored.
Yeah. Seamlessly so. Yeah.
There's great craft in it.
It had me in stitches.
I mean, and it is, genuinely.
It's sad that Day-Lewis doesn't have that award sewn up.
Oh, yeah, but he does loom over...
Over everything.
Over the award season.
Yes. Yeah. Like a phantom thread.
I feel like we've threaded the needle on this
one. Yes. I'm not somebody who, to my great shame, I don't always notice the score or the soundtrack of a film, but Johnny Greenwood's score for this film is incredible. Like, it heightens the tension in all of the right places. It gives the film this very interesting flow, this sort of push and pull that mirrors kind of the power dynamic between Day-Lewis's character Reynolds Woodcock and his sort of Reynolds Woodcock.
Well, Anderson and Day-Lewis apparently were in stitches when they came up with the name. As you might imagine, like Anderson is a very funny man. Like, he's a great auteur, he's one of the great directors, but you tend to think of them as, like, stuffy and removed. Like, you think of them in the style of, say, you know, I mean, obviously, Kubrick, but even, like, you know...
I thought you were pointing at Stuffy, like,
but, like, Kubrick, or even Nolan's public persona and stuff like that, you tend to think of, like, an auteur as a serious filmmaker. Mm. Whereas Anderson, like, is a great serious filmmaker, but he also names characters Reynolds Woodcock.
Well, that's because he just loves Billy Bob Thornton.
Sitting at home watching the movie going, well, this is like...
he was going to call him Mr. Glasscock, but then they'd see that coming.
Oh, wow. Ladies and gentlemen, the podcast is just rated or.
He seems like a very quietly funny man. I mean, he's married to Maya Rudolph, who's this great comedic actress, so I'd say that house is just gas. And right after he made Magnolia, this, you know, epic chronicle of chaos and humanity, he was asked what his next project was going to be, and he said, well, a 90-minute romantic comedy with Adam Sandler. And then that's what he made.
And it's great. It's one of his best films.
It is one of his best films. But yeah, Phantom Thread, I think, deals with sort of one of the central themes of his work very interestingly, which is kind of the question of, you know, what will make me feel powerful? How can I seize some small amount of power in a chaotic, unpredictable world that is mostly beyond my control? And I think it does that quite well with kind of both of its central characters, with both Reynolds and Alma. And yeah, it's beautifully realised. I really adored it. I had such a good time at Phantom Thread.
Great breakfast movie.
Yeah. That was PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson, a great showman.
Oh, and nice then, segue!
But
realize that the segue you've set up leads to only one conclusion.
Only one conclusion, which is I went to see The Greatest Showman this week.
That P.T. Barnum
is better than
the greatest
showman. Sure, Paul Thomas Anderson is great.
But is he the greatest showman? I mean, I've never seen a film about Paul Thomas Anderson called The Greatest Showman. So.
Starring Hugh Jackman? I would love that.
That sounds like a
Mr. Woodcock would be an amazing number. You're a mean one, Mr. Woodcock.
Who plays Mr. Woodcock in the Paul Thomas Anderson Greatest Showman? That's some hot casting for 10 to 15 years.
Zac Efron, there we go.
Zac Efron, yes.
With all the screen presence of Daniel Day-Lewis.
So yes,
you look good doing it.
You'll get there.
Woodcock wooden performance.
So yes, PTB, P.T. Barnum, The Greatest Showman.
Okay.
Not without its charms. It's sold as a big musical. It's Hugh Jackman in the lead role. I do think Hugh Jackman would be happy, and that audiences would also be happy if we just gave him one of these to do every couple of years for the rest of his life. But you know, it's not substantial in any great way, I would say, certainly not in the greatest way. The songs, when I watched the movie, as I was watching it, I found the songs to kind of go on a little bit too long. Also, the first two songs you hear in the movie are performed by children. And that kind of grated on me a little bit, and all those
it's a hard knock life for us.
It's that, but like for way too long.
From the songwriters behind La La Land.
Yes.
As somebody who likes La La Land.
And you know, I don't dislike La La Land. I might take similar issue with the songs, in that I find them kind of generic. They kind of go on a little bit too long. But having said that, them going on too long means they start repeating the same kind of refrains over and over again. And the result of that was, they've been in my head all day today. I've had, you know, various songs. After leaving The Greatest Showman and going, well, those songs weren't up to much, they've been stuck in my head all day.
You have the greatest showreel of The Greatest Showman.
Yes. And, yeah, it's kind of interesting in some ways in how it treats P.T. Barnum as a hero. I mean, it's, you know...
Well, yeah, the exploitation of people with disabilities and impairments and stuff like that for the entertainment of the masses in order to line his own pockets.
Yeah.
And the film, I haven't seen it now. I'm one of three people in the entire country who have not seen this movie. But as I understand it, it paints him almost as a progressive in some ways?
Not
Okay.
As a progressive as such, I mean, they do show him being pretty down on these people.
Okay.
Like, there's a scene in which, and spoilers for, again, the handful of people in the country who haven't seen The Greatest Showman, Barnum is attempting to kind of legitimize himself and his circus after building up kind of a following with these unusual-looking circus performers, which have kind of made him a lot of money, given him a bit of sort of capital to expand, and he decides that he's going to try and legitimize his circus, his show, by bringing in this European opera singer to perform. She's not even an opera singer, for one thing, which is kind of annoying. It's like they pitch her as this amazing opera singer. She basically sings a song that's the equivalent of like a Kelly Clarkson B-side. It's really not up to much.
From the songwriters of La La.
From the songwriters of La La Land. It's a Kelly Clarkson B-side.
I feel like, yeah, what The Greatest Showman needed was more opera.
Mm. Yes, always more opera. It's like, how can you call this the greatest show if yeah. they're not even singing opera? But yeah, you see his attempts to kind of associate with her to kind of legitimize himself through this form of high culture, and then his circus performers show up at this party that he's having for, and he like slams the door in their face and doesn't want them part of it, makes them sort of sit in the cheap seats while she's performing. So, you know, the film shows him as being, you know, pretty down on them and actually investing a lot in this sort of classy opera singer who then ends up, you know, leaving the tour that he has arranged for her halfway through and costing him everything. But then, yeah, the circus performers, again, spoilers, find him at his lowest ebb after this opera singer has left him and his circus tent has burned down. Which,
sorry,
everything falls apart real quickly.
If it didn't burn down, then you'd... He'd have to have done it.
He'd so. Have to burn it down.
Like, no, screw it.
I'm about to say, does the film answer that question? Is it just like, well, the insurance money for this will cover my lack of opera singer? What a coincidence.
It's not enough for my world to symbolically burn down. I need to burn it down.
I couldn't afford the asbestos.
But yeah, then you see them rallying around him after he's lost everything and saying, no, it's okay, you gave us a home, you made us a family, and now we owe it to you to help you get your life back together. And I left the film real razzed about that, because...
No, bad!
You don't help him, he's not nice.
But he's Hugh Jackman.
He's Hugh Jackman, he's so handsome but nice.
Yeah,
though.
I feel like you've lost that battle the moment that Hugh Jackman in a musical...
With
yeah.
the top hat and the tail.
Yeah.
Come on. Like, this is like Les Mis, which cast Hugh Jackman against Russell Crowe. It's like, which side am I meant to root for here?
Always the stage.
Darn, he stole bread.
You, hello? If you tolerate that, the next thing you have is revolution. As the stories
will roll.
So yeah, it
at least he wasn't caught loafing.
So it doesn't necessarily shy away from making him look like an asshole, but at the same time,
it does legitimize
him in a way by casting Hugh Jackman to play him and having kind of these very kind-hearted performers rally around him at the end. It's not so much, oh, he's an okay person, as, oh, they're better people, even though they're not handsome like Hugh Jackman. But I mean, you know, it passes the time. The songs are generic, but they're pleasant. It's kind of frothy. I mean, a motif of this film is people telling Barnum he's a fake. This film is kind of a fake.
It's a completely Barnum biopic.
Yeah, so it's very suitable.
Yeah.
It's candy floss. It's like just fluffy, substanceless, frothy.
Hugh Jackman flavored candy floss.
Hugh Jackman. Sure.
Ratio. The only one that I really is worth talking about is I once saw Geostar.
Geostar.
Oh yeah. Imagine taking any regular Roland Emmerich film and then taking the Roland Emmerich out of it and leaving behind nothing. Dean Devlin. God damn you. You wrote Stargate and I want to like you, but you... God, it's awful. Geostar is a 2-hour long film
in
which
storm?
The first hour is just nothing. Essentially, it's all set up for far too long. It is the story of two brothers, one played by Jared Butler, who is the world's most gifted scientist engineer. Yeah.
That's our character.
The character. And the other played by Jim Sturgess, and he is a bit of a dick. And
The character, yes.
And so the world has had enough of the freak weather, and they decide to put in place geosynchronous satellites, thousands of them, to control the weather and to stop extreme weather conditions happening,
Well, as far as premises go, it's no neutrinos are going to take
it. No, it's high science. The idea behind it is interesting. Up until this week, we had no means to put any of these things into space. Which was my biggest problem while watching it. I was like,
yeah, that was
none of this could actually happen.
That was your problem.
Well, I had many problems. Yeah. Jared Butler as a scientist. But then Jared Butler is the maverick scientist. So he gets benched. And then two years later...
No science for you today.
For a climate scientist, you're a bit of a hothead.
Yeah, it starts going wrong, and accidents start happening, and he's sent back up to the space station to figure out what's going wrong in the system that he built. And so we should be off to the races, but no, we're still on this sort of mystery of the week thing where he has to try figure out if the people on board are involved, the people on the ground are involved, who is involved in this. Or if it actually is a malfunctioning thing, but then there's code in there that shouldn't be in there.
That's always riveting in a disaster movie.
Exactly.
Rogue code.
You have two action sequences when it goes wrong at the start, prompting the need to bring him back and send him up. And then you have an hour in which nothing happens except just, the investigation and the conspiracy on Earth and back up in space, and you're just like, oh god, would you just get to the thing? It's called Geostorm. I came here for the Geostorm.
For the Geostorm, stay for the Butler.
That's the thing. I mean, the satellites going rogue, what they can do, what they can precipitate is a Geostorm, which is a storm that just keeps happening. So it's like a hurricane after hurricane, and then that feeds in and starts another hurricane, super hurricanes happen, and lots of bad shit happens. Except that doesn't happen until about half an hour before the film ends. And so it's essentially a little bit like Pompeii in that respect. But in Pompeii, you understand why you haven't yet got to the volcano exploding, because that is your thing.
Yeah.
So, but in Geostorm, you're like, no, come on. Come on.
There's no reason you can't start with a Geostorm.
That's the
Robert Evans approach. The geostorm stays in the film.
If you had it happen halfway through, you can have people trying to escape, but you can have all of that sort of thing and the various different, and the scientists looking worried that this looks like it's going to be
Paul Giamatti in the San Andreas approach.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, San Andreas, if we're on that thing where The Rock is the titular hero who abandons his responsibility to save his own family.
He steals a search and rescue helicopter to travel from San Francisco to Los Angeles to save his daughter.
That is dereliction of duty.
Yeah, he should be court-martialed.
To be honest, nobody survived, so it's okay.
Also, are you going to challenge The Rock see him?
The Rock is a new film coming out next year called Skyscraper.
Yeah. Is it actually? Is it seriously?
Yeah, there's a trailer for it. Oh my god.
Is it a disaster movie?
Ish. Yeah.
Ish.
Towering Inferno with The Rock.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
I am there. I've seen San Andreas, I hated it, but I'm still there.
The best thing about it was there was a poster released for it, and essentially what happens is it shows The Rock jumping off the top of a crane into the open window of a skyscraper that's on fire. Right. So the image is brilliant. But
he ran into the fire now.
Somebody worked out the parabolas and the speed that The Rock could possibly have got to and whether or not he would have made it.
I like that you're assuming the laws of physics as we understand them apply to The Rock.
So somebody said that unless he was running faster than Usain Bolt, so that he set the 100 meter record at the same time,
he
would not have made the jump. But somebody else then came back and said, but there would be thermal updrafts caused by the fire.
I kind of want to see that. I'm flying.
There's science. Scientists having a conversation about this.
But scientists, like some scientists love the Roland Emmerich movies. Oh, yeah, back to talk about Geostorm, just because of the absurdity of trying to make sense of them.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't know. They wouldn't know.
The core is not a popular science.
The core is still one of my favourites for the fact that I fish. It's the screen. So the screen is getting hit by birds, so the birds have fallen out of the sky and the things, and one of them is a fish.
That was a full star on Niall's trip.
She's just doing the sheer balls of doing that. Anyway, on to the news and talking about bad disaster movies. Netflix have done paradigm shifting work. During the Super Bowl, they decided that they were going to launch the trailer for Cloverfield Paradox. And then 4 hours later, when the Super Bowl ended, it went live on Netflix worldwide. And so that was a ballsy move.
That was.
Hello. For a terrible film.
It's an absolutely appalling film. It makes no sense. It was famously bought from Paramount. The deal was arranged in late January. $50 million it cost. $10 million for the two Super Bowl commercials. Released on day and date with 2-hour notice. No critic screenings. No hype. No billboards. No cinematic trailers. No screeners sent out. And just a massive pop culture event. All that anybody was talking about on Monday and Tuesday mornings.
It overshadowed the Super Bowl, which was the Super Bowl was brilliant. It was a really good game, and it went down to the wire. Tom Brady threw a Hail Mary in the last minute. Had it been caught, they would have had a chance to equalize. And yet still, no people were talking about
Cloverfield Paradox.
Cloverfield Paradox.
Which is astounding for a movie that bad to dominate the cultural conversation. But all credit to Netflix for the work that they've done. I mean, it's astounding.
It's just one of these things where it became a cultural event, and
it's an astounding bit of marketing on the part of Netflix, because this would have been a direct-to-video film, and I mean, no disrespect to direct-to-video films, the last two Universal Soldier films from John Hyams are great, but this would have been like a burn and forget about its sequel. This would have been a movie that would have, like, if Paramount had released it, it would have been another Paramount box office bomb, but Netflix turned it into a cultural event.
Do we think this is going to become the norm now? Do you think we're going to see many more surprise launches of Netflix?
Possibly. But it means, why wouldn't you want the hype before the film?
Yeah, if it was a good film. This is the issue with it. The issue with, like, having watched The Cloverfield Paradox, the issue with The Cloverfield Paradox is that it is abominable.
Yeah.
It is a bad movie. It's not a bad movie in the way The Book of Henry is a bad movie. This is a bad movie in the way that it's just boring and dull, and a composite of films that you've already watched, bad science fiction films of themselves that were at least fun. So it's a bit of Life, it's a bit of, like, Prometheus, it's a bit of Event Horizon, it's a bit of Alien, it's all these things that you've seen done before but better, thrown together into a stew and, like, served up in the most unsatisfying manner. There's a moment where one of the characters goes, hey, logic does not apply, and that is all you get in terms of justification for what is happening. It's got all this, like, multi-dimensional nonsense crap happening. It's got news, like, scientists who watch InfoWars in order to, like, listen to exposition about the experiment that they're conducting. It's terrible. It's terrible, terrible, terrible. And the thing is, like, Netflix releasing it this way turned it into something much bigger than it would have been if it just arrived on cinemas and was dead at arrival. It would probably even have killed the Cloverfield brand, you know, had it arrived in cinemas like this. However, because it was released via social media online immediately, it turned into this huge conversation starter. It was just, it's astounding how good Netflix marketing was. But, like, you look at the films that Netflix is releasing, right? You look at the work they're doing, and I think Netflix is doing outstanding work. So you've got stuff like, say, Beasts of No Nation, you've got stuff like Okja. Okja opened at Cannes, for example. Like, Beasts of No Nation, they sent out screeners to critics. When Mute is released at the end of the month, you can be absolutely guaranteed critics are going to be hyping that from the beginning. Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, which is another, like, Paramount co-production they backed out of, and Netflix are like, we'll take it. You can guarantee that come Oscar season, they will be pushing that up the hill. The reason that this got dropped, you know, astoundingly or quietly or subtly or surprisingly, had nothing to do with the fact that this is Netflix disrupting the existing social model of, like, screening for critics ahead of time, and all to do with the fact that if critics had seen it ahead of time, nobody would have wanted to watch it. It would have been basically the equivalent of those Adam Sandler movies, The Ridiculous Six or whatever, or The Ridiculous Eight.
There are six of them. Anyway,
yeah.
They're all dreadful.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's made all six of them yet.
It just feels that way when you watch them. But yeah, Netflix, if this had been a good movie, Netflix would have released it a conventional way, which is why I don't like the discussion about it, where you're like, this is showing critics who get to see movies ahead of time. This is democratizing movies. This is sort of, there's that weird sort of populism attitude that you see with, like, the DC stuff, with, like, Paola and Marvel buying stuff off and all these arguments. And I don't like it, and I feel worried.
Or the George Soros is buying everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean,
how could he possibly be buying everybody?
That's on both sides as well.
But that's exactly what this is in terms of film criticism. Because, I mean, you look at movies, like, movies have been released direct-to-video before, The Avengers in 1998, or, like, obviously, like, Proud Mary earlier this year from Sony with Taraji P. Henson. Mm. Like, movies have gone to cinema without critics having seen them. Independence Day Resurgence, to speak of Roland Emmerich films, went without critics seeing it because it was dreadful, right? But the issue is that, like, if you hype this and you think that this is, like, taking power back to you, the people, you're basically falling into that trap of saying, like, this is something for the fans rather than for the critics. You're Henry Cavill having the argument defending Justice League, saying, well, we didn't make this for the critics, we made it for the fans. And the implication there is that fans just have no taste, but they believe that it's made for them, so they'll support it to their dying breath. Hey, you know, say these movies, like, say Three Billboards of La La Land, which get great reviews. They're like, this is, you know, critics don't know anything, etc., etc. Like, there's a lot of anger out there towards critics, and I felt uncomfortable with how quickly this got folded into that. I'm sorry, that was a little bit of a ramble.
No, I mean, this is the thing. Netflix have had this thing where they've released a number of films that have been very, very bad, or a number of TV shows that have been very, very bad.
Yeah, like Iron Fist, for example. Yeah. Iron Fist screened for critics. I saw Iron Fist before anybody else, and it was still terrible.
Or the six-picture deal with Adam Sandler. Or the Altered Carbon, which is their latest big thing, which is...
Altered Carbon, I hear, is at least fun.
Yeah, but not everything that they've touched is gold. But
no.
Because they are doing something different, and they are offering something different to what the mainstream.
But here's the thing, though. Like, because if you think about it, like, if Netflix looked at Cloverfield Paradox and said, "We have got a surprise hit on our hands. This is I don't know what Paramount were thinking when they sold it to us. What they were smoking. This is a frickin' masterpiece. This is like Duncan Jones's Mute, or this is like Martin Scorsese's The Irishman." You don't think they would have, like, sold the hell out of it to critics? They would have been doing, like, press screenings and circuits and stuff like that, and maybe embargoed it until the day before. Like, the way in which this was released was not, like, a radical reinvention of what they're doing. Because, like, Netflix, to a certain extent, as much as they are a change, they are a game changer in terms of, like, organization, in terms of distribution, in terms of access. And I think that's great. Like, that they are financing movies like The Irishman, which can't get made in the studio system, films like Mute that can't get made in the studio system, Beasts of No Nation, for example, Mudbound. All these films that can't survive before, they're financing them and making them, and that's fantastic. And I think it's amazing. I think they deserve to be lauded for that. But yeah, if you think that, like, this is a game changer based on how they market a Cloverfield Station, then, or Cloverfield Paradox, then, you know, I suspect you've got another thing coming. It was marketed this way not because Netflix is changing the rules of the game. It was marketed this way because Netflix realized that they could cleverly, and marketing team deserve all the marketing awards in the world for the way they did it. They discovered that they could manipulate the release of this film in order to make it look like... Because this is an important film in inverted commas. It's just not a good one.
Because it changed the conversation as to how the distribution is done in the digital age, then from that perspective it is important. But
I don't think this will be a norm for films that are any good, is the issue. Like, if Netflix have a film that's good, they will trumpet it from the rooftops. Because, like, the AV Club or Pitchfork or God knows who else online saying, look, this is on Netflix, this is a good film, you should pay for Netflix subscription to see this film or this TV show, is still worth more than, you know, people online going, oh my god, there's a new Cloverfield movie already on my phone. It's not great, but it's on my phone. It's just a marketing hustle. And I feel like That was always a concern, but I worry that nowadays it has more currency than it used to. Like, that people buy it more because they want to believe that, you know, something is being tailored for them specifically, rather than wanting something that's good.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
I think there's something to the surprise novelty element.
Oh, yeah, there is.
As well, right?
Because
yeah. Everybody likes a surprise. Everyone likes a novelty. Everyone likes something that they are not expecting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not within every area of life. certainly, there are some times when surprises are not welcome. But, you know, just to, you know, be watching the Super Bowl and seeing that, oh, hey, you can watch Cloverfield in a couple of hours. And you didn't know that was coming. Like, that's fun. That's exciting. But I don't know. I think this sense of whether it's good or not, like, that narrative will kind of fizzle out once people actually watch the damn thing and realize it's terrible. like they're going to realize, oh, this isn't something you do for a good quality film.
Yeah.
If they do watch it right after the Super Bowl, then that, you know,
yeah, they
the cycle ends as quickly as it
begins.
Yeah,
but in order to sustain that, they will have to release something good.
Yeah, in this exact same way.
You know,
yeah.
They can't let
yeah.
it.
Because if they keep surprise dropping terrible films...
Why does this wonderfully wrapped package smell bad?
Yeah, so it's, yeah, I don't think it's something they can sustain, as you say, for very long.
No.
If the films are not up to scratch.
We should be so lucky. I mean, the fourth Cloverfield film is still being released in cinemas by Paramount, it should be mentioned. It's called Overlord. Surprisingly, it's not called Cloverlord. I'm quite disappointed with that. Starring Wyatt Russell.
Yeah.
They haven't finalized the name for that yet. But what I really loved about Cloverfield Paradox was the fact that the posters line up.
Oh, with the lines at the top of the bottom.
Right. 10 Cloverfield Lanes. The
has
line.
A little tunnel down underneath. Could be. And by the way, we should be clear, I absolutely love the last two Cloverfield films. I'm not an uncool critic, internet people.
Just uncool.
But, I mean,
I'm just uncool.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about this is, as you've mentioned, it didn't begin life as a Cloverfield film.
Yeah.
So
but
what does that mean?
But
for
then neither did 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Neither did 10
so,
Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah.
So I guess it works both ways.
But I mean, yeah, one of the issues with the one of the issues of the film.
One of the
sorry,
myriad issues.
I'm sorry, I know that when I said one of the issues and laughed. But one of the issues with the film is how it ties back to Cloverfield, because it ties back to Cloverfield in a way that is as logical as anything else in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, oh, by the way, it's also a Cloverfield movie.
Remember,
credits.
Remember
looking
that
straight at the camera.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Cloverfield.
Yeah. It's pretty much it. There's
yeah.
a moment at the climax, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody
they,
who hasn't seen
they
it.
They show the decapitation.
Where one
just,
of the characters turns the camera. What? You told them to what? You didn't tell them this was a Cloverfield movie? And then you see a Cloverfield thing and it's credits.
You're like, ah,
I see what they did there, even though it makes no fucking sense. The cast. What the cast is amazing.
Was
David
Ayala,
yeah.
an Irish astronaut? Our
it
first
is Chris
Irish O'Dowd. Astronaut.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Good for Chris. Good for fictional Chris O'Dowd. It is, and the comic relief, not playing up to stereotypes at all. He isn't drunk, though, which I did appreciate. He's playful and he's bantery, but he's not drunk.
Right.
So
well,
it would be really irresponsible for an astronaut to be drunk.
The German guy is untrustworthy, and the Russian guy is perpetually angry.
Okay, great.
The Chinese woman is competent
and secretive.
And secretive.
Drinking alcohol in space is probably a bad idea because
yeah.
I'm pretty sure it does not work the same way it works out here.
Science.
Yeah.
There's only one way to be sure. We
yeah.
need to
yeah.
launch a crate of beer on the next Tesla up into orbit of Mars.
Surely
yeah.
it'll be sponsored by Budweiser.
Exactly.
A massive Bud Light logo.
It'll twinkle across the stars every Friday night.
Yeah.
I was actually reading something about an astronaut who was saying that like all the junk that we put up into the atmosphere actually makes it unsafe.
Yeah,
for astronauts
absolutely.
Who are operating up there.
Oh yeah, because you could get hit by it.
Yeah. That's
something
I thought about quite a bit.
Just imagining
yeah.
the hit and run with the Tesla.
Well,
car.
Tesla has no lift, so
yeah.
it's on its way
it's
to
okay,
Mars.
Yeah.
So you know, or into a heliocentric orbit between Mars and Earth. With that.
I know, but I'm just imagining the highest hit and run on, in like history.
I'm just thinking, yeah, if that was your Uber driver, you'd be waiting for a while.
Yeah. Matt Damon sitting there on Mars checking his Uber. It's like, damn it.
We're turning closer to home. We got an addition to the Dublin Film Festival, so so Disobedience was taken out of the programme and it has been replaced with Gareth Davis' new film, Mary Magdalene. So, the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So, yeah.
Surprisingly enough.
played by Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara, respectively. So, and they're coming. The two of them are going to be here with Gareth Davis to do a red carpet event and then nothing else.
Smile and wave and then...
That's it. There's no introduction. There's no Q&A. Which, you know, like, being honest, no Q&A... Not a horrible loss, as somebody who's like been to film festival events. But there's not a discussion beforehand. There's not an introduction. There's just a red carpet because it's in the Savoy now.
Yes, the first film in this program to be out to play the Savoy, and the only reason it's playing the Savoy is so you can do the red carpet because it's the only place that has that much space.
Yeah. Because, you can't do it in the Lighthouse because the corridor is too narrow when you go downstairs. You can't do it in the Odeon because it's like climbing Mount Mordor.
They've done some in Cineworld.
They do have the space, but...
Yeah. You have to reach out. They did Daddy's Home there, I suppose. But I suspect Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara won't draw, like, Mel Gibson and Mark Wahlberg crowds. Which, is not necessarily a good thing, but I think is a thing.
Yeah, I know it will be something. It will be an event anyway.
And it's a great addition. And I mean, being honest, I'm surprised that Joaquin Phoenix is showing up for this. But will he be around? He won't be around for You Were Never Really Here.
No, I don't believe
which
so.
Which is a shame because I mean,
it's a few days prior to that.
I'm just imagining Joaquin Phoenix in residence at the Dublin Film Festival. How amazing would that be? You Were Never Really Here is something I'm really looking forward to, actually.
So it's going to play on the 28th on the Wednesday.
Opposite Isle of Dogs and Red Sparrow and Twilight, I believe, as well. Pat Fillon's Twilight.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And
schedule conflicts!
Yeah. Well, yeah, so it's...
a hot day.
I will be missing it because I'm going to see Paul Dwan's new one, so...
as well? Oh, okay.
Yeah, Twilight's on before Paul
Dwan's. Oh, okay,
Paul
so they feed into
one
another.
Yeah,
and it's short, so...
It's 27 minutes, so it's what, three minutes for every euro?
Yeah.
Moving on, it's
25 euro to go to see Mary Magdalene, so
really
it is it's astounding. And obviously there's no Q&A and it's in two screens,
and you know what happens.
Spoiler. I mean, not only do you miss the twist when he dies, when he comes back you're like, well,
obviously.
Yeah,
okay.
it's still a great
movie. I would love to see it. Unfortunately, I'm going to Isle of Dogs, which is great. I love because it sounds like I'm saying I love dogs. Isle of Dogs and Red Sparrow and Cineworld.
Top 10. At 10. Darkest Hour.
Still there.
Our Dullest Hour.
It's perfectly
Darkest Hour.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah. It is not perfectly grand. It's fine for maybe 20 minutes and then it's terrible.
It's a delivery mechanism for Gary Oldman to feed scenery into his jowls and collect an Oscar.
Yeah,
but the end.
The sequence on the train, which everybody is aware of, it not being a star with him and not a spoiler. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah, the moment where the three people say, never, never. Never. And you can see the gears twisting in Churchill's head, and he's like, wait a minute. If I repeat the same word in a speech, it seems impassioned.
It'll get stuck in people's heads the next day, and they'll remember it.
Yeah, that is the issue with Darkest Hour. It's a movie that believes Churchill learned rhetoric like 5 minutes before delivering his most famous speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's... Yeah. We're not going to go into the
benefits of a classical education.
Churchill.
Yeah, that's not the biggest problem.
It's all one word. Right. You're looking for a church or a hill.
Yeah, yes.
What is the deal with Churchill?
It's all one word. Churchill. Yeah.
Tiny green balls.
I don't think they were green.
At 9, and it's also still in the charts after 7 weeks.
Amazing.
Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle.
I'm amazed there are people either who haven't seen it who are going to see it multiple times.
It was still playing in 60 cinemas.
What can you take kids to? What can you take kids to at this moment in time that isn't Jumanji?
Early Man.
That's a fair point.
Coco.
Fine, let me rephrase that.
Even The Greatest Showman, if you don't find
and they don't want opera.
The main brother, if they're that bit older. Plenty of choice. There's no reason to go see Jumanji anymore.
But hey, it is the bedrock.
But it's
of
done
it.
So much.
It has.
Worldwide as well.
And who could have seen that coming?
I mean, it's just, it's The Rock, isn't it?
But I mean, like, The Rock, you know, I mean, his franchise Viagra reputation being what it was, like, Baywatch didn't do amazing.
Before, yesterday, in the, Yesterday in America, for example.
They greenlit a sequel, didn't they?
Jumanji was the second highest grossing film yesterday.
Yesterday, in the
Woo!
States.
Yeah. It is the fifth...
And we're in the middle of Oscar season, people, so don't let that put you off.
It is the fifth highest grossing film released in 2017 in the US.
Our culture is doomed.
It's just... That's just phenomenal. It's made $860 million.
They're bringing back the writers.
We're talking about $1 billion.
It's going to make $1 billion by the time it's done.
Yeah.
It's theatrical run.
And people didn't go see the tour. It's terrible. Anyway, Phantom Thread.
It's grand. I didn't like it as much as Stacey did.
Really?
No, I liked it. I thought it was very beautiful. I thought it was very clever. It just left me emotionally cold. It was like,
says the man who loves Christopher Nolan.
You say that, but like, all Nolan's films are predicated on a very basic emotional understanding, which is the fear of loss, or the fear of lots of time slipping through your finger. A very relatable human fear. I feel like, without getting too spoilery about Phantom Thread, I feel like Munchausen by proxy, by consent, is less of a relatable emotional condition. And I mean, I understand it on an intellectual level. I think intellectually it's fantastic. I think it's a very clever exploration of the relationship that, like, creative men have, like, with the women who they surround themselves with. The idea that you don't want a lover, you want a mother. That you want, basically, you make yourself emotionally unavailable. And we as a culture celebrate that in creative men to a degree that is unhealthy. And I think it's very clever. I think the performances are great. I think it looks fantastic. I think it sounds great. It doesn't resonate with me. It didn't click with me in the way that, say, obviously The Master did with its exploration, like The American Dream and the desire to want something more, or like Inherent Vice with its desire to make sense of a senseless universe. It didn't work for me in a way that a Paul Thomas Anderson film hasn't worked for me, you know, going back to Magnolia. Magnolia is the last Anderson film, which I appreciated technically, but which just left me cold.
Once it started raining frogs, it lost you.
Which was the opening scene.
Logic does not apply.
There is no logic here.
At 7, Maze Runner to Death Cure.
Phantom Thread is much better than Maze Runner the Death Cure, just to be absolutely clear. Yeah, Maze Runner the Death Cure is a film. It is a conclusion of a young adult series that nobody cared about, that arrived at the point where Twilight was over, The Hunger Games was winding down, Harry Potter was winding down. It was these films were starting at a point when everybody had given up on the young adult boom.
But there were so many of these
and
done.
Mortal
How
Instruments.
Did you just get three of them?
Because it's not competent.
Yeah, but
it's basically which is like, keep in mind, like, that's the bar. We all go and we all expect The Hunger Games and Harry Potter, which are like the gold standard of young adult, like, you know, adventure films. Like,
or Twilight, yeah.
What, Twilight? Is Twilight a gold standard? Twilight is...
Well, it's another one of those sagas that resonated
with a crowd of people, yeah. And I mean, but the issue is that so many of those movies were just terrible, like The Mortal Instruments, which I love, but is terrible.
Oh, Mortal Instruments is terrible. Beautiful Creatures is great.
Or Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thieves. That sort of stuff.
They got two of them.
I know. And I would argue that Maze Runner is like of a sufficient level of quality that it deserves one more installment on that scale. Like, it is precisely one half better than Percy Jackson.
We got one Golden Compass and we
Golden Compass predated this, right? Golden Compass was very early.
We got it's marginally better than most of them.
And it's clever.
Way less dark.
We only got one Lemony Snicket.
Well, they're all way.
Which was the big. I mean, we got the TV series subsequently, but
that's true. And we're getting
a
Northern Lights,
Northern Lights
TV show,
so.
Which should be good.
Yeah, but I mean,
just denuded of like the rampant Christianity, and then
atheism, isn't it?
Well,
I thought the trilogy, the Northern. I thought that was
The religious overtures. Like, well, yeah. Also what you need to do with Narnia.
Yes, sure.
And there you go. There's another example of a perfectly moderate young adult franchise.
Yeah.
With Jesus line.
Played by Liam Neeson. But yeah, Maze Runner is grand. It's, you know, the best thing it has going for it is that it's entirely honest about how horrible these dystopian futures are. It's a movie about child soldiers that is actually about child soldiers. Mm-hmm. And it's really uncomfortable and awkward.
So
but
is Ender's Game.
Ender's Game is, but I mean, Ender's Game also has, like, the Orson Scott Card thing tied
to it. I'll get into that guy.
Yeah.
What was the one, the other one that got, like, four, or three into the four, and then decided that...
Divergent.
They didn't bother making the last one going to television.
Yeah.
Oh, is it actually still going to television?
Apparently it's still going to television, which is astounding. Oh,
it's a long time since the last one came out.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges, and was Julianne Moore in it at one stage?
She was.
Kate Winslet was in the first one.
She is, yeah.
That's the one that was basically, yeah, super randy. It was basically like, lawyers and doctors will protect you from street gangs and cars.
They were split into three different
But with very clear good guys and bad guys.
Yes, the white hat, black hat.
We don't want to generalize about entire classes of people, but street gangs are awful. Farmers are pure.
I'm sorry, if West Side Story has taught me anything, street gangs are not. They're amazing.
But, and you're going to find you
just for street gangs.
Yeah.
Steven Spielberg's West Side Story. Yeah.
Come on, tell me you're not excited about
that.
Why is
Channing Tatum's in it? I'm on board.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Really?
Channing Tatum has been wanting to do it for years. So.
That's your line as a Spielberg fan. It's like, opening night, C. Tate is not in it. Now I'm just sitting there staring at the screen going...
I used to hate Channing Tatum.
I love Channing Tatum.
I used to think that he was absolutely useless. He was a poor man, Sam Worthington. And
that was your turning point.
Yeah.
Then he suddenly started like making brilliant... Magic Mike is really great.
But yeah, Jay Courtney is the poor man's Sam Worthington.
Yeah.
And Sam Worthington is the poor man's
Russell
Crowe. It's the very poor man's Russell Crowe.
Sam Worthington's coming back now in Avatars 2, 3, 4. So.
Oh.
Well, it's not as if he's doing anything else.
He's in a TV show, the Unabomber show. Yeah.
I thought that was a documentary.
It was. It was the documentary.
Starring Sam Worthington. Join us tonight as we reveal.
It was a docudrama. So based on like the criminal files or the FBI profiling and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite good.
I quite like Mindhunter.
Yeah, Mindhunter was better.
Yeah.
It being a David Fincher production.
At six, Den of Thieves. Also,
Jared
Butler.
back to Jared.
Why do I keep watching terrible movies? But no, this is...
Why is he in all of them?
Because all he made.
Fair.
But, come on, this sounds more fun than Geostorm. Let's be honest here.
No, Geostorm is... There are satellites controlling the weather. Come on.
Den of Thieves is heat. With Jared Butler playing late-stage career Al Pacino. Come on, tell me that doesn't make you exciting. It's a man who's powered by nothing more than coffee and whatever scenery he can cram into his mouth. It's a movie that unironically asks you to accept the image of, like, Jared Butler standing on the edge of the ocean, staring out and contemplating the emptiness of his existence. I mean, come on, tell me that doesn't interest you.
Hard pass.
Dead. Soulless eyes.
I don't really like him at all, but he
goes for it, and it's like, it's watching somebody go for it, and you're like, I admire your trying, and I feel like, you know, casting Jared Butler as like early career Al Pacino would be a horrible mistake, but I feel like letting him loose on like, hoo-ah, Pacino would, you know, is, you know, grand.
Yeah, no, I'm out. But here's the thing.
More for you, Derek.
I can eat all the scenery and drink all the terrible coffee.
It opened in nearly 40 screens more than Phantom Thread.
Oh, yeah.
And it made almost 20 grand more than Phantom Thread did. because of the fact that it opened much wider.
I mean, obviously it's a much better film than Phantom Thread 2. No, it's not. There's only so much I can stress that.
But no, it's one of these things where there's something severely wrong with the method of cinematic distribution in Ireland.
Yeah.
In that, because the thing about Phantom Thread, about the distribution of Phantom Thread, is that it opened in 19 cinemas. 15 of them were in Dublin.
Yeah, we should probably talk about this because there's going to be an issue next week as well with Lady Bird.
Lady Bird is opening narrow and then wider.
Okay, is it pushing?
That's the idea behind this. It's having a staggered release. So
is that common in Ireland? I know it's a big thing in the States for award season films, but does that happen here?
No, it's not common here. It happens with some of the smaller films. But one of the things that generally happens when it happens in America is it opens in four cinemas in the two cities.
Yeah, Los Angeles and New
York. That's it. And then broadens to maybe 40 and then broadens again to...
Yeah.
And so they step it up incrementally. Yeah. But here, staggered releases are unusual. And I don't understand why you'd go wide the second week against I, Tonya.
Well, you're going...
Why not get it wide out now?
Week one, yeah.
And so is wide week one not going to put it against Black Panther, for example?
Yeah, but it's not... It's very much counter-programming to Black Panther. It is...
I don't know, having seen both films.
My mother will go see Lady Bird. My mother will not go see Black Panther.
Yeah, I'd say age-wise, maybe. We're looking at, like, age-wise.
I think demographically-wise, I feel like Black Panther has a sort of... It's a wider net than most, like, superhero films would be.
It does. It's one of the classic four-quadrant type films,
but... But I mean, yeah, the thing is... Like,
I wouldn't go against... Like, I don't know why you'd have... Because then... It is a shootout between the two of them.
Yeah, well, I'd be surprised. Like, I loved I, Tonya, to get that out there. Like, I adored I, Tonya. I don't see it performing that well here.
No, it won't do as well as Lady Bird. Because Lady Bird's going to do well here no matter what.
Yeah, because of Saoirse Ronan. Yeah. Like, this is what's surprising about this. Because Phantom Thread as well has Daniel Day-Lewis, who is Irish. Mm. You know, he is... Like, we are very proud of him in the same way we were very proud of Saoirse Ronan. Like, you would imagine... It would be a very easy sell to go. Like, my parents went to see Lincoln, and my mother hates, like, constitutional dramas. literally the first thing she said and then she came out was, Daniel Day-Lewis was great, but did they have to talk so much about law?
Yes!
It's the whole point of
Lincoln.
I feel like that's what's so astounding about these films. Like, I can understand, like, doing it with, like, a... You know, I could almost understand doing it with Darkest Hour, say, or whatever. But, like, doing it with films that have strong Irish interests seems baffling. Yeah.
And plus, yes, Paul Thomas Anderson isn't everybody's cup of tea, but he is an established name.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the towns that I'd be talking about where it hasn't opened are college towns.
Yeah.
Well,
why the hell not? I mean...
And I mean, it's not as if the cinema's overflowing with great films. I mean, Den of Thieves is out.
In
but,
58 cinemas.
But I mean, it's not as if, like, at this moment in time, like, the cinemas are saturated. Like, because you have, like, when we get to the next couple, you'll see, like, there's a couple of big films in there. But, like, when you have, like, The Greatest Showman in, what, its sixth week?
Sixth week. Yeah.
Climbing to the top of the UK box office. This is the season.
It had a help. It opened in the IMAX.
Like this week?
Yes.
First time you can see it in IMAX?
That's one of the things that happened. It went into IMAX.
Wow.
All that music and fiery really
yeah.
IMAX.
Yeah.
Real good.
But still no opera.
No, still no opera.
But I feel like this is the time to be doing it, to push wide with it, because it will turn into... Because, I mean, it's not only, as you pointed out, I, Tonya, Lady Bird next week, or, in the week after. There's also, like, The Shape of Water as well. Like, it's... And I mean, you're going to have three billboards sitting around as well. Like, you know, there will be no better time than right now, or last week, to have done it.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's an odd one. At five, open the widest possible one, widest possible. The Post, because Spielberg sells to everybody.
And that's great. I'm very glad to hear that. Like, it's an adult film.
Yeah, and it's adequate. It's perfectly adequate as a film.
And I mean, it's a great launching pad for, David Neary described as the
Washington Post universe, the Walpole of shared universe. Yeah.
I don't know, I still maintain that was Spielberg parodying the way that you have to get modern films made. That was like a sly, winking nod.
Or traditional Spielberg not being able to end the film.
Fair point, too.
I feel like if you just cut the film off, you would end the film.
Or the but then it was a spec script that was turned around in a short time. So there is also that. Had it gone through a couple of more iterations, chances are that would have been cut.
It's just a shame it doesn't lead into Steven Spielberg's West Side Story universe. Not yet, it doesn't.
Somewhere Steven Spielberg's listening to this podcast and saying, get me my writer.
Well, we have Ready Player One next before we get to West Side Story. So, that's the shared universe. There's a copy of the Washington Post.
It's a virtual reality game in which you play the role of Ben Bradley.
It's like how Pixar films foreshadow future Pixar films. Yeah. Spielberg films have all these little clues.
But the thing is that the Ready Player One, the book is so heavily based on Spielberg, and yet there are no Spielberg films in the films.
Yeah, because understandably he feels uncomfortable doing that to himself.
His own nostalgia. With the exception of some of the ones he produced.
Yeah, so obviously like the Back to the Future car.
He has a DeLorean, of course.
I feel like that's different because like you're always celebrating other people's work that you enabled, as opposed to like, I mean, is there going to be a Poltergeist reference in there? But you're celebrating work that you enabled. I feel like that's justifiable nostalgia, as opposed to going, aren't I great? Because imagine how insufferable like the internet would be if Spielberg turned out a film that amounted to, aren't I great?
But here's the thing. The thing about Ready Player One is that it would, to film it, would be so absolutely impossible if you needed to be faithful to the book, because there is no way you'd be able to license all of the properties that you need.
How do you know it's in the book, even? Or is it like veiled? Is it illusions? Is it actually in
there? No, they're all
the book is very overt.
Because I've read a chapter of the book, and that was all I wanted to read.
Terrible.
Ready Player One fans.
What you can do is, rather than read it, you can get the audiobook and it's Will Wheaton reading it. And at what point Will Wheaton turns up in it?
No way.
It's Will Wheaton talking about himself.
Poor Will Wheaton.
At four, it's Early Man.
Glad to see this perform quite well. I haven't seen this one because I went to see a terrible film instead. My family did go and see it though, and they all loved it. They thought it was fantastic. So that's a high recommendation.
It's real cute. It's real wholesome.
Yeah,
just like a good, fun, all ages movie.
It's Escape to Victory, you know, except in caveman times, as opposed to The Great Escape, but with chickens. I feel like sense a recurring theme coming up here.
I think someone's trying to get out of our
the story group meetings. I've been trying to seed this to you guys forever.
I want to see more Pirates in an Adventure with. They're based on books, and there's a load of them.
And that's like Hugh Grant being funny before everybody realized he was funny in Paddington 2.
Paddington 2 is amazing.
So good.
It's a warm comfort blanket of a movie.
It's so good.
And I'm sure this is as well. Just
Early Man, also very, very nice.
Act 3, The Greatest Showman.
Which we've talked about at length.
Yes.
Yep.
Number 3, that's high.
Yep.
Would you go so far as to say it's huge?
So sixth week,
And number one in the UK.
And number one in the UK, which is just phenomenal.
We want to talk about like Irish boosts, like the fact that an Irish related film held quite well against this suggests that maybe we could get a Saoirse Ronan film.
Can we get Saoirse Ronan shared universe?
47 Saoirse Ronan.
Yes.
Ronan starring Saoirse Ronan.
That would be amazing. Is she the Jean Reno character or the okay?
She's all the characters, like a Norbit type thing.
Yeah, also she's turning up in Guardians of the Galaxy as well.
As a Smurf, is it?
As Ronan.
Poor Lee Pace.
He's also in
Book of Henry.
We have Sarah Silverman, Jacob Tremblay,
Naomi Watts.
It's astounding. Dean Norris. That cast is insane.
Yeah, and what's his name? The guy who would never leave Saturday Night Live but finally left Saturday Night Live. Billy Moynihan, that's the one. I love that Billy Moynihan got the biggest cheer there.
I like the idea that Keenan is still in Saturday Night Live after 10 seasons.
Some people are comfortable where they are.
Oh, yeah. Will Ferrell came back to present it last week. interesting. It was actually one of the better ones from the season. Now, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is at 2. Talking about things I never want to watch again.
It's great, Niall, so and I will not hear you.
So my wife went to see this
yesterday.
I really liked it, and then we had to have a discussion yesterday.
We had about to have a discussion? Jesus, Niall!
She initiated the discussion because she wanted to know from me why I didn't like it.
You have to set her straight, is what I'm getting from
this. No.
I know.
This is what I'm saying. Because she was like, I genuinely liked it. I don't understand why you didn't. Why did you not? So this was when I had to explain my myriad of reasons why Three Billboards is not a good film.
If you're listening, Sinead, was wrong.
I'm always wrong. That's fine. I'm used to being wrong. That's not wrong.
Now there are two of us. I really, really liked it. I still really, really like it. I think it's flawed in its handling of race, but I still think it's very well constructed and cleverer than it gets credit for.
I mean, I would still recommend it on the basis of its performances, while acknowledging, hey, this is a Martin McDonagh film, and you're not going to get anything more
complex. Let me guess something a little more complex. But yeah, I'm willing to concede I'm in the minority.
Yeah. It's still doing well. It's up to 1.6 million.
And I mean, everyone knows that box office equals objective quality, Niall.
Exactly. Yeah. Jumanji, 2.6.
Give me this. And it was still the least bad Dwayne Johnson movie last year.
It's a high bar. high bar.
They can't all be Baywatch, luckily.
Or Fast and Furious 8 or whatever numbered around there.
Okay, the second best.
Coco is at number one.
Good for Coco.
Yeah, third week in a row. So.
Oh, hey, cool, that's good. Well, I suppose it plays probably plays very well here because it's about family and stuff. It's about connecting with people. And
why do you hate it, Darren?
I don't hate it. I think it's perfectly grand. Wow, this turned aggressive very quickly. No, Coco's grand.
Why have you no soul?
What happened to your heart, Darren? Yeah.
It's such an interesting contrast.
Who hurt you, Darren?
But, okay, Coco's grand. It's lovely. It's a very well-made film. It just feels very cookie-cutter to me.
I know it is. You want to build a wall. Don't you? That's it.
Your wall around my heart, Niall.
A wall around
there's
my a
heart.
Secret red Maga hatch under there somewhere.
Maga makes it sound like very Irish. Maga. It's got to sound like Magog. No, I don't want to build a wall. Thank you very much. In case there's any ambiguity there. I think, again, reiterating a point I
made. Dad would have liked it a lot more had to be white fellas and not set in Mexico.
Jesus! It's escalated quickly. Thank you for waiting until Coco to spring the Darren's racist trap, by the way.
I don't understand.
Week 4. 2018, we got there eventually.
We got through Three Billboards without it. No, I think it's grand. It's well made. It's just not great Pixar. It's perfectly solid, like, family entertainment. I recommend going to watch it. I think it's about as good as Mona, which is horribly underrated. I think Mona is a horribly underrated Disney film. Like, is it as good as Inside Out? No. Is it as good as the Three Toy Stories? No. Is it as good as Up? No. Is it as good as WALL-E? No. Is it as good as The Incredibles? No. Is it as good as Finding Nemo? Possibly. Is it as good as, like, you know, monsters?
They're incredibly high bars.
Yeah, they are, but when you consistently hit those high bars, I feel like you deserve to be measured against them. And I think this is grand. Like, this is okay. This is maybe better than Brave?
Yes.
Okay. Better than Monsters University?
Yes.
Maybe in the same range as Finding Dory? Like,
no, Finding Dory. I've seen Finding Dory a lot. I mean, my son has a Dory teddy that is as big as a small chair. It is a huge thing on there, and he sleeps with it. He lines up all his teddies on his pillow so that there is only the space the width of my phone for him.
Sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's a real good setup.
He goes to bed and he puts down Dory, then he puts down Bullseye from
Toy Story.
Then he puts down a pink pig from IKEA, then him, and then Fireman Sam and his sleep teddy Jerry the giraffe. He goes, so Fireman Sam's on one side, Dory's in the other, and the others are lined up with him in the middle. And then at the end of the bed is a big elephant, a massive elephant. called Ellie, and
Clever.
There's a one-eyed alien, and they sleep at the end of the bed because there isn't room for them at the top of the bed.
In the cold, dark exile of the other side of the bed.
But then there's also a net of teddies, so it hangs from the ceiling to the floor.
Okay.
It's about, you know, it's about the width of a laptop.
Sounds like some sort of horrific death trap.
And it has all these teddies in it, like including the Baymax and the Gingy from Shrek and all the rest. Essentially, the child has so many teddies, he must have about 50 teddies. But the really sad and depressing thing is that at least 40 of them are mine. I gave to him when he was born.
That's not as sad as you still keeping them after he was born. Let's be
passing
them on. Yes,
these are my teddies. You don't get
to
touch them.
No, you can't.
We talked about them. They're not toys. They're adult, they're sort of like grown-up entertainment mechanisms.
Well, hence the Baymax and the Wally and the ET and all the rest. They were all mine originally. But
anything from Coco up there yet?
There is nothing from Coco. There's no memorable fluffy things to the same extent. I mean, you could have a skeleton. But you know, he's got a Jack skeleton, so he already has the superior skeleton.
But yell at me about how I hate Coco then. I'm not the one who won't buy my son toys from a film with Mexicans in it.
I have a Book of Life thing.
Book of Life is quite good, actually. Book of Life is about as good as Coco.
That is the end of the top 10. So on to this week. So it's going to be an interesting week.
It's a quiet week. Next week is a monster week.
It's too many things.
Yes. Next week is everything.
It's overwhelming.
It's a bit mad, though, isn't it, that they went down this route where they packed everything into one week, and this week is a bit...
Particularly the week before Valentine's Day as well, because Valentine's Day is the Tuesday. Right?
Also Pancake Tuesday.
It's Valentine's Day as well?
Valentine's Day is the Wednesday. So it's Ash Wednesday. So technically you should be starting your fast or whatever if you're into that jazz.
Kind of thing.
On the day when you really don't want to be doing that. You have to be eating as much as possible. Wallowing in your misery if you are alone. Or whatever it is that, you know...
sad, lonely people do now.
I'm married with two children. I think that
came across quite well from your statement. Niall feels you, single people. He recognizes your right to eat as much as you want on Valentine's Day, or do whatever you lonely people do.
Anyway, out this week, whatever lonely people do. 50 Shades Freed.
Which, surprisingly, I didn't get invited to the press preview of. I haven't seen the other two, but I'm kind of curious. I wouldn't mind seeing them. I'm just never going to pay to do so.
Apparently it didn't screen in the UK, and a bunch of UK critics went to France to see it.
I don't know what the story is. I know the guy Lodge went to France and ended up with some sort of tote bag that he was very fond of.
But yeah, I don't know that there have been that many screenings.
There isn't even a screening this week for it anyway. Yeah, 50 Shades Freed, the third part of the 50 Shades trilogy. So if you've watched the other two, you will watch this.
It should be like 53 Shades Free to avoid conclusion, right? To avoid confusion. Because I mean, if you got them on yourself.
50 Shades Freed.
There we go, yeah.
Why didn't they ask me?
Yeah, it's like, now you see me, now you don't.
That was pathetic. They really should have called it Now You Don't.
Should have been the next one.
Now You Tree Me.
Yeah, Exclamation mark starring Hugh Jackman as a rival magician. It's basically The Prestige.
The Prestige gave us David Bowie playing Tesla, and this week we got a Tesla playing Bowie.
Full circle. I've heard this is a tamer offering than the previous installments in the 50s.
Which means that it's
because they're married now, and it's like, okay. But
they're tame anyway.
They are pretty
tame.
This is a film about a guy who's really
into S&M, and it's not in any way about S&M. Like, this is really strange.
I would wager good money that despite being less overtly sexual, that, like, you know,
it made it more,
that Phantom Thread is more overtly like a kinky movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would argue there's a lot more kink in Phantom Thread, I suspect.
Oh yeah, or the Duke of Burgundy, or
okay, well, yeah, that's an explicit example. But
yeah, but the 50 Shades, just enough to get people interested, but not too much that you would
offend
you.
It's the bondage movie you could send your mother to.
Yeah, but it was called Mummy Porn when it came out. That was the thing.
But it was also originally Twilight fan fiction,
so therefore you know you're
on the an underserved audience, to be honest. Like, they're,
I made a phenomenal amount of money, the first one, anyway. Not so much the second one, but. Anyway, also.
They're called the 50 Shades of Green.
Also out, The Mercy.
Is good. I actually quite enjoyed
Colin Firth on a boat.
Yeah. What? Colin Firth on a boat. That's your pitch there. Actually, like,
that's a good pitch.
That is a good pitch.
Like, and we are
Bridget Jones is the one where they're boating and not so much with the comfort in the boat didn't work.
I don't know, like, how much to recommend or hype this. I don't know how many people are familiar with the story of Donald Crowhurst. I wasn't very familiar with the story when I went into it. So, all I knew was that it's a movie about Colin Firth on a boat with a poster which has Rachel Weisz and Colin Firth staring at the audience in front of, like, a beautiful sunset horizon. And the title, written in italics, said, The Mercy. And it sort of, it looks like one of those, and it's from the director of The Theory of Everything, so it looks very much like one of those inspiring stories. And it starts out with its first act about this guy, Donald Crowhurst, who wanted to be the first man to sail across the world, or the fastest man to sail across the world, single-handedly. Right? And it begins with this sort of weird, like, pro-Brexit parable about, like, British exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. There's, like, he's a weekend sailor. He's never been out on the ocean.
He's a bit of a woodcock.
Yeah. He doesn't own a boat. he has no corporate sponsorship. Yeah, he doesn't have any corporate sponsorship. But he somehow wants to sail around the world faster than anybody else has done so before him. And everybody's all like, no, this is a crazy idea. You certainly shouldn't, like, leave the continent that you're on to venture out into the middle of the ocean and be by yourself. And all these other people are like, actually, this is a great idea. You've got spirit.
We really don't like you, go away.
This is one way to get rid of
like, that Churchill spirit is how one of the characters describes it, and that lost British derring do. And so, like, in the first act, this is the thing, though. In the first act, it looks like it's going to be this.
Fosberg, the man ended up killing himself because he kept wanting to fly a balloon around the world. This is the same idea,
but it is, like, it starts out as this really weird sort of pro-Brexit sort of, like, parable, and then once he gets out to sea, once he realizes what he's done, he has no plan for what he's doing. He's got no idea how he's going to accomplish everything that he promised he would accomplish.
So, and absolutely Brexit.
It is at sea. Then it becomes, like, it goes from being this, like, pro-Brexit propaganda, which initially appeared to being Brexit the movie. And it's astounding. Like, it's wonderfully mean-spirited. It's the most brutally horrific, like, twisted biopic I've seen in a long time. It's got, like, it is a little bit too conventional in places. There are moments, like, when he's lost at sea.
Shark turns up, sort of.
But it's got this, all these flashbacks and stuff to his family life. And there's a sense the film doesn't really hold the character to account as much as it should. But, like, there is a real, and it's not as vicious as, say, I, Tonya, which is the, if you're only going to see one deconstructionist biopic, like, this month, wait and see I, Tonya next week. But if you have it in you to see two, and you like downers, and you really like human suffering, I say go see The Mercy. It's got far too many flashbacks and memories and, like, conversations. And there's a moment where it's very clear, like, they originally cast Kate Winslet as his wife, and she was replaced by Rachel Weisz. But you can tell that the role was basically beefed up in order to ensure that you could have a second lead on the film. Mm-hmm. And the film suffers from that. It would be much better if it was just Colin Firth on a boat. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Lonely Island song. Mm-hmm. And it's very good. I really, really liked it. But it's not perfect. And if you want a really bitter, sarcastic biopic, just wait next week for I, Tonya.
Sure.
Also out this week, Loveless.
The Russian film.
Yes.
Which the Irish Times is describing as, like, one of the best cinematic experiences they've ever had, or one of the best experiences you could have in a cinema.
That's just doing
gangbusters in terms of like reviews it did. It's a, like across the board people have adored it.
Yeah.
Did it get an Oscar nomination for Foreign Language?
It was I don't know. It was Russia's entry anyway, and I don't know if it ends up in the shortlist. But yeah, it has won across the board many awards from that.
And there,
it's up for the BAFTA anyway for the and it was nominated for the Golden Globe.
I'm not going to try and pronounce his name, but. Andrei Zed, let's call him. I saw Andrei Zed's last film, not his last film, but Leviathan. I went to see in the IFI last week.
Siv Ankensiv.
Marvelous.
Yeah. I'm looking at the phonetic way to pronounce it.
It's like not just something you knew, just intuitively. But yeah, marvelous film, really incredible. Sort of an underdog story that's not really doing it justice to describe it as.
Oh no, the fight is amazing.
It's incredible. It was a really good movie to see in a cinema as well, even though I went in and realized I had forgotten my glasses for a 140 minute subtitled Russian film, so I was right at the front kind of craning my neck back, back and forth reading the subtitles, craning my neck back, because it is really beautifully shot. You have these fantastic shots of the landscape.
It did make it again. Oscar nomination is on the Oscar list.
Loveless.
Along with Square, On Body and Soul, The Insult, and A Fantastic Woman.
It deserves to be on there by judging by it.
By the response.
What everyone says about it. You
know, so. A lot of love for Loveless.
Yeah. So what else have we got this week? Status update.
What?
Tad, the Lost Explorer, and the King of Midas, which is
this is a very empty week. This is a very empty week.
And the 1517 to Paris.
Oh,
yes, which nobody seems to have seen, despite the fact that as we're recording this, it is releasing tomorrow.
And white as well.
Well, it's a Clint Eastwood film. Yeah, obviously, it's going to do well. It's starring three non-actors from the makers of Four Non-Blondes.
It's the guys this happened to, right? So these are some American soldiers who stopped a train from being held up. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
In
and
Paris.
It stars the actual American soldiers.
They did that with, what was the name of the film a while ago? Something of Honor, Men of Honor, I think it was, where they cast actual SEALs as Navy SEALs. But
otherwise
it was
known as US propaganda film.
Which is what this sort of looks a bit like.
Well,
the good news about it is currently 11% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I'm liking Eastwood.
A 6.1 on IMDb, and The Guardian said that he derails the tale of real life terror. So there we go. I think we'll give that.
I kind of
might miss that train.
Yeah.
Even Eastwood can't make this one run on time.
No.
Right, and with that, we leave it there for the week. Cool.
Cool.
Yeah.